I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Thanks, Ken. And I think last week we got partway through discussing how you can keep your banker happy with the price that you'd paid.
You said that it's difficult to get a seller to allow you to buy subject to finance. Instead, what you really need to know is the maximum figure a valuer would support. How would you obtain that?
Yeah, you're right. People do tend to feel a lot more comfortable having their contract subject to finance so that they can check out whether or not the funds will be available. But actually, they're approaching things from the wrong angle. You see, you don't need to have your finance approved before you go into a deal and make it unconditional. And besides that, in the commercial market, the vendors will not allow you to take the property off the market for any length of time that you need to get that sort of approval. You see, what I've done in my consulting team I put together for clients is to include one of Melbourne's leading valuers. And I've done that because he is on 95% of all valuation panels for the financiers. So if we know what's in his mind as to the value of a property, we also know that it's going to be acceptable to all the top financiers. So I've got him there really for three reasons. The first one, as I've said, is to make sure that clients don't pay more than what the financiers would be prepared to lend against. Now, that's important because you don't want to have surprises down the track. And many people over the years have felt that they've done top deals in packaging up a purchase proposal, only to find that the banks will not lend the 70% based on the contract price. The valuer has come in at a lesser figure and they'll only lend 50 or 60% of the contract price. Now, that has always caused by economic circumstances, but if you'd known up front what a valuer would support, it overcomes those sort of issues. Now, the second reason for including the valuer is that armed with the upper limit that he provides, you can also find that very helpful when you're undertaking negotiations with a vendor or the vendor's agent where you reach an impasse. And if you're able to trot out this figure from a valuer who's well regarded in the industry, that selling agent can go back to his client without he or she themselves talking down the price and simply explain that here is a well-regarded valuer who's come up with a figure, and as far as my client as the purchaser is concerned, he or she is not prepared to exceed that because it means they'll have to tip in more equity and it won't be supported by the bank. So in other words, if my client doesn't buy it, well, everyone else that's looking at the property is going to have exactly the same problem. So it tends to bring a bit of sensibility to the vendors and can help to lower their expectations as far as price is concerned if you get down to the very last point in the negotiation. I said there were three reasons, and I'm going to keep the third one until we reach the step of actually arranging your finance, and you'll understand why. But anyway, this is the point at which you start taking control of the whole finance process. And that means that you have the comfort of knowing that you haven't overpaid, but more importantly, you're able to avoid some of the major nasty surprises that people get down the track through unwittingly agreeing to a price that can't be supported later by a valuation. So therefore, with that in place, you're now ready to negotiate to buy the property.
And so how exactly would you go about putting together the initial proposal to purchase your chosen property?
One of the very first things you need to understand about negotiating is that it is not an event. It's actually a process. It's something that can't be hurried, and it's something that if you do hurry, one or other of the parties, if it's rushed, gets the feeling that they've either sold it too cheaply or they've paid too much. And so you have to respect the process of negotiation. In simple terms, there are basically only three elements to every negotiation. The first one is power, The second is information. And the third is time. Now, when you take power, there are probably seven or eight different sources of power. And as a newcomer to negotiating, or even if you know property quite well, most people fail to understand that they actually have more power than they realise. And it's understanding what constitutes power, how it's used, and we're talking about the ethical use of power, not manipulation. You can structure a negotiation in such a manner as to actually turn the tables on the other party. And when it comes to information, again, most people don't realise that before the negotiation actually starts, the other side seems more than eager to share information with you that you can use to your advantage down the track during the course of the negotiation. And then there's the aspect of time. Now, the reason you use time to your advantage is that over the course of the negotiation, you can gain the confidence of the other party, but also gain commitment from the other party in small steps. And what we generally find is that 80% of the concessions occur in the last 20% of the negotiation as you get closer to the deadline. Now, the deadlines, in many cases, people state deadlines, and mostly they're artificial. But if you and this is, again, during the information stage, that what you need to try and identify are the motivations of the other party, which may be as to price or settlement, or they may have a deadline. There may be financial pressures. But it's identifying what they are and then arranging your negotiation and the proposal so as to provide to them what they need while at the same time achieving what you want out of the negotiation itself. But what's important is understanding that you need to have more than one aspect under negotiation throughout the process.
You talk about the need to have several negotiable components within your first purchase proposal. Why is that so important?
Well, yes, there are several components. In fact, there's about six in most negotiations that we'll call our variables. Now, we won't have time to go into them all, but probably the main three which are common to all negotiations would be the price, obviously, the due diligence that you need to carry out on the property, and the settlement date. Now, obviously, if it all comes down to price, which most people tend to focus on, at some point, someone's got to lose. And so the more items you can negotiate, the more balls you can have in the air at any one time, it takes the focus away from the price. Now, the settlement date, obviously, you would start out at 120 or 180 days, knowing full well that you can settle in 60 or, if push came to shove, even 45. But again, it's a negotiating point. It's something that you can trade. Again, the price might be low to start with. You might even introduce a split deposit. In other words, probably start at 1% on signing the contract and a further 5% as soon as the due diligence is complete. Now, the due diligence is important, and most people tend, again, to get things out of order. If you do the due diligence before you make your offer, the implication is that the figure you're offering takes account of any impediments you found with the property. Now, what I like to do is say to the vendor, effectively, look, we believe everything you say. Your property's fine, and therefore you won't have a problem if we do a due diligence study as part of the contract. In other words, it doesn't extend the settlement period. It's done during the agreed settlement period, but we reserve the right to do that due diligence study. And we have probably, you know, I'd start at 21 business days, but the team I've got can probably do it in 7 business days. Now, you need to understand that 21 business days is actually a month when you take the weekends, and 7 business days is actually 10 full days. So it's not it sounds shorter, but it actually is quite a reasonable period. So the important thing is that when you structure your negotiation, that you avoid leaving the other side with the feeling that they have lost. Ken, in the time available, we're barely going to scratch the surface of how to structure a successful negotiation. So if you like, I'll give you a link to put beneath this podcast for anyone wanting to explore this in more detail because I run an online negotiating masterclass, which may be of interest. But before we finish on the topic of negotiating, it's such an important issue. I thought what we might do is to cover the four approaches you can adopt and the implications of what that means, and also then the resultant effect that each of them will have. The first approach that most people tend to adopt is to try and convince the other party that their position is what ought to be accepted. You do it with persuasive argument, sometimes with cajoling, hopefully not with manipulation, but generally it's to get your point of view across and accepted by the other side. And in the process of doing that, you need to realise that the results you achieve is that you win and they lose. And if you think about it, that's rather short-sighted because you've all heard of buyer's remorse. Well, if this is how the negotiation was conducted, I can assure you that the other party will certainly have remorse after the deal. And so your problem arises is that generally a gap between finalising the agreement on the commercial terms, even if you note them down informally and follow up with an email afterwards, you still have to document them by way of a contract. Now, a lot can happen between doing the deal and actually having it consummated formally. And therefore, by using this approach, the convincing, where you win and they lose, you run the very real risk that people will renege or want to renegotiate terms of the deal. The second approach is where you capitulate. In other words, you are so keen to get the deal done that you tend to reach agreement with the other party simply for that reason. In other words, you give away the farm, sure the deal's done, but in that instance, as you can appreciate, you lose and they win. And if that's your approach, over time, that's going to prove to be very, very costly. And certainly if you have to meet that person again in the area of commercial property investment, the marketplace is relatively small. The same vendors and purchases seem to pop up over and over again. And I know that while you don't have to dominate the other party, you have to have the respect of the other party so that when you do encounter them again, they don't consider you to be a walkover, which if you capitulate, that's the result or the implication or inference that you will be leaving them with. Now, the third approach is to compromise. In other words, you don't get what you want, they don't get what they want, no one's really happy. So in that situation, you lose and they lose, and it's unsatisfactory. You both accept the fact that you've both borne pain, but it's not a good feeling or a good taste in your mouth when you finish the deal. You walk away and you just feel very uncomfortable about it. Now, unfortunately, it's those first three ways or approaches to negotiation that most people use or that's all they understand. They don't realise that there is a fourth and better way, and that is to collaborate, where you spend the time finding out what's important to the other party, and in the process of doing that, you end up with a shared solution. It's not so much a compromise because, as I say to a lot of my clients, in all of my time, over 40 years, both parties will have an agenda. They'll have items listed of what they want to achieve. And yes, there may be some common items on each agenda, but in the whole time I've been in commercial property, I have never seen two identical agendas in a negotiation. In other words, what's at the top of your agenda may actually be item number 5 or 6 on theirs. And it's the skill of understanding and learning how to determine where the various components sit on their list relative to yours. So that while you might trade an item in your list number 5, you know it's number 1 or 2 on their list. So for them, it's a big win. And you appear to have made a concession, but in actual fact, it's not that important. And so that's the secret to successful negotiating. It's a skill that is easily learnt, but it's something that you really need to master if you're going to be successful with commercial property investing.
So now you've negotiated a good deal. What's your next step?
I mentioned that you don't actually raise questions about the property at the proposal stage, but the secret is to reserve the right to check everything out. Now, you might say, well, why would an owner agree to do that? Aren't they effectively taking the property off the market? Well, as I said, the approach I use is that if they balk at offering or being prepared to allow you a due diligence period, I will say to the selling agent, so you're telling me there are problems with the property. And therefore, they can go back to the vendor and say, look, we're not going to do a deal here because they obviously suspect there are problems because you're not prepared to grant it. Do you have problems with the property? Are you aware of things that are wrong with the property? And the vendor will obviously say, well, no, it's perfectly all right. So the agent will then, wanting to do the deal, the selling agent will convince the purchaser to allow the due diligence period, a reasonable period, and particularly when it's not extending the settlement period, it's done concurrent with that. So, as I said, you assume everything is fine or let the vendor believe everything is fine, but you reserve the right to just check it out. And so your due diligence period is where you satisfy yourself that you bought exactly what it is you thought you had purchased.
Is this where you look at the structural integrity of the building?
It's not only the structural aspects, but all the services as well. Plus, what you want to check out is all the legal documentation too. In other words, you don't start the meter ticking with your lawyer until you've done the deal. I mean, they might have a cursory look at the contract to make sure there are no nasty unforeseen clauses, but the really serious investigation doesn't occur until the contracts are signed and exchanged and you start your due diligence period. So they need to review the contract, the vendor statement, the leases that are involved to make sure that they accord with what the marketing material purports them to be. You also need to look at the financial aspects to make sure that the outgoings and the capital expenditure expectations are as you have been led to believe they are. And also, the physical condition, but as well as that, you have to look at the compliance issues, because there are things like essential services, which are very important now. And as a commercial landlord, you have to carry out inspections every 6 months and have the logbooks kept on site. And if you're in a body corporate or owner's corporation situation, most of that work is done for you. But within the tenancy itself, that's in the common area, but within the tenancy itself, you have to make sure that your exit lights are working, your paths of ingress and egress are clear, all sorts of things like that. Now, you don't have to concern yourself personally with them, because there are consultants that carry those out, and in most cases, the tenant will pay the cost of that. But you, as the owner, are responsible to make sure that it complies. So therefore, your due diligence, part of that is to make sure the consultant going through verifies that what should be occurring under the legislation is actually occurring. So you flag them. But you see, the due diligence is interesting. In many cases where I've helped a client purchase a relatively new property where the developer is selling it, he has built it, leased it, and is selling the property. Most developers have a very high level of personal pride as far as their product is concerned. And therefore, if there is anything wrong with the property, and I don't mean major, but minor things like a loose door jamb if it's in a warehouse, or in one case we went through and there was some stains on the tiles in the ceiling, nothing major, but there'd obviously been a leak in the roof. Plus, it's not right that you should buy a property that have stained ceiling tiles. So we flag that, and the way we do it is that the due diligence is undertaken, and we get within 48 hours from the consultant a report explaining, in most cases, that everything's come up smelling roses, but he might flag two or three issues that need to be addressed. So this was one of them. And when we went straight back to through the agent to the vendor, he immediately said, not a problem, that will be fixed before settlement. The issue apparently was that someone had been up on the roof doing some minor work and had a cup of coffee and left the empty coffee cup there, which had got stuck in the box gutter. So when it rained, it obviously pondered and it got through and came through the ceiling. So immediately that was cleared up. The ceiling tiles were replaced and everything was fixed up. But again, in most cases, the vendors want to make sure they hand over a good property. And by doing it this way, you hold the whip hand. In other words, in some cases, if it's not a developer, we might get the consultant to cost the rectification works, and there's a simple adjustment at settlement for that amount, and you undertake the work yourself, which is probably far better because you then know the work's done to your satisfaction, but an allowance is made at settlement. So it's a very simple process, but again, it's addressing the issues of comfort and you knowing that you can sleep at night. So Ken, maybe it's worthwhile me just recapping what we've covered to date. We started out by looking at your high-speed filter of properties to get on the shortlist, which is really a comparison of how well your investment objectives are met by each property. And then you do your full financial analysis, and you can use software in the marketplace, or my clients use the software that I've put together specifically for commercial property, so that you end up with a very simple comparison with, as we said, that internal rate of return on an after-tax basis. Then you need to know before you make your offer that you have not paid more than a figure that a valuer is prepared to support. And armed with that, you then enter the negotiation phase, which is one where you never allow everything to revert down to resolving the price. You've always got three or four or five balls in the air at any one time of aspects that you're negotiating. So as you deal and trade on each one, you know exactly where you want to end up, what you can give away, how quickly you can settle, and therefore you end up with a proposal that works for you. And then you set about doing your due diligence to make sure that the deal that you thought you negotiated is actually the deal that you end up with. So I think that should recap to where we are at this point.
Once again, Chris, it seems our time is now up. So thank you for joining us today, and I look forward to continuing next week from where we left off.
I'll look forward to that too, Ken.